It is Monday, February the 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, citizens caught in the middle of the fight for the Iraqi city Mosul.
You've got a tremendous international effort backing a huge Iraqi and Kurdish effort. And everybody knows that, you know, you don't want to go back and fight it again, so be nice to the population.
Also ahead, going after Islamic State fighters from the Mediterranean. Plus, what's to happen with the U.S. Environmental Agency and what's buzzing on social media? Hello, everyone. Associated Press is reporting that Iraq's operation to retake western Mosul from the Islamic State has brought a surge of casualties. More than 200 civilians have been killed or wounded in the last 3 days, as well as 30 Iraqi soldiers. Iraq's military does not release official casualty reports, but medics at the frontline clinics provided figures on condition of anonymity. All of this comes as Iraqi forces, backed by the U.S.-led coalition, have pushed deeper into western Mosul, capturing two more city neighborhoods from the Islamic State. VOA's Victor Beatty asks former U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy for his thoughts on how the battle is for western Mosul is going.
This is going better than expected, but it often happens in a major battle that at some point, particularly if you're besieged and you're under constant air attack, the other side begins to crack. And the other thing is they start thinking seriously about, can they withdraw and fight another day? And while the city is technically sort of surrounded, there are still routes out, which will be of some concern. The other thing is, since the Trump administration came in, it's clear that the rules of engagement, the nature of the firepower that has been committed and all of that by the United States, the more forward deployment of advisory and air control teams, this is all having a real effect. But ultimately, the credit goes to the Iraqi elite forces, and all of the elite forces in the Iraqi army are involved in this fight in West Beirut.
Well, there was some concern about their ability to conduct such operations not too long ago. So has your opinion improved in the estimation of their capability?
Sure. When they went into Mosul, they had a lot of problems, even the counterterrorism service. But what's improved is they're much more careful in clearing areas. They've learned how to deploy tanks in the direct fire and support role right up with the infantry, and that's where the tanks protect the infantry protects the tanks. That takes some coordination and training, and it's pretty complex. But, you learn through doing, and they've had 3 months of doing this, and they're clearly a much, much better force now. Their morale is very high. They've replaced some of the casualties they took initially, and I think that this is ahead of schedule, frankly.
There was always some concern that the civilians and the tight construction of the streets, alleyways, and so forth of western Mosul, the concentration of civilians would make this a very slow process. Are you concerned about civilian casualties?
You're always concerned about civilian casualties, but it comes at two levels. One is civilian casualties that are either deliberate or non-deliberate, but are so massive that they have an impact on the morale and the attitude of a whole civilian population. That's Aleppo. I don't see that happening here. They've been very careful in East Mosul. And as you know, most of the civilians stayed in place, some tens of thousands, maybe a bit more, went into refugee camps, but they've been able to basically deal with this. And this, again, is something that you've got a tremendous international effort backing a huge Iraqi and Kurdish effort. And everybody knows that, you know, you don't want to go back and fight it again, so be nice to the population. You know, there'll be some individual cases, as we've seen in other battles, but the Iraqis have done this in Ramadi and Fallujah and Tikrit and in East Mosul, and I think they'll be successful in West Mosul as well.
Last week, Mr. Ambassador, the Pentagon indicated that a plan to accelerate the campaign against Islamic State will be delivered to the White House. What do you think that might contain?
Well, it'll focus on several things. One is as the president indicated and as in his remarks at the time he signed it, and since then in various open press. First of all, it's a defeat ISIS. It starts with defeating the caliphate, which is basically primarily in Mosul and in Raqqa, but it's still holding on in Dar al-Zor along the Euphrates, close to Raqqa, and in Palmyra. But it's under pressure in all of those places. It's just lost al-Bab to a Turkish Syrian resistance force. And so it's to destroy ISIS as a state, retake the territory. Secondly, it's to go after ISIS around the region. And then thirdly, more broadly, it's to, and this is where it gets interesting, how to keep ISIS from coming back. ISIS, as we know it today, is a product of Iran's grab for power in the region after the vacuum created by Barack Obama. The tolerance and even incitation of Prime Minister Maliki's actions against the Sunni Arabs in Iraq and President Assad's in Syria is what created ISIS as a force to be reckoned with among the 20 million Sunni Arabs between Baghdad and Damascus. And so we've got to figure out a way to ensure that doesn't happen again. And what that points to is Iran isn't our ally in this effort.
James Jeffrey is a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, also a former U.S. ambassador. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. U.S. Navy is striking Islamic State targets from an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean after 2 months without a carrier in that region. Our Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb was given a firsthand look at the strike operations from on board the USS George H.W. Bush. Speaking now from the island of Crete just after getting off the aircraft carrier, she explains what it's like to observe the operation from on board the George H.W. Bush.
It was a pretty incredible display of the Navy power in action. They have conducted 184 strikes on the USS George H.W. Bush since February 13th, and it was just go time for them. I mean, there are 5,000 sailors on the ship, and they were launching the day that I was there from the very morning to about 10:30 at night. I would watch five or six of the aircraft landing, and then minutes later, they would catch about five or six more. So it was just incredible. I was talking to the pilots, and one of the pilots had just flown an eight-hour mission that day. Another one that I was talking to had flown every single day that they were carrying out strikes and was finally given a break on Friday. So they are working really hard, but they know how important this mission is, and they want to continue it.
Carla, what are the advantages of doing these strikes from an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean?
The advantage of shooting Islamic State targets from an aircraft carrier multiple ways, the way that the captain was explaining it to me. The captain said that one advantage of shooting from an aircraft carrier was the flexibility that it gives the military. You're shooting from a land area in some points, but sometimes you don't want to have to ask permission from other countries. So if you have international waters and that ability, that gives you that flexibility there. Also, it's convenient. Because depending on where the targets are in Iraq and Syria, sometimes it will be closer to shoot out of the Mediterranean Sea and strike targets there. So multiple reasons for shooting from a carrier.
Do I have it right that the H.W. Bush was late in getting there?
That's right. The George H.W. Bush was delayed. They had some scheduled maintenance that they needed to go through. And as the captain was kind of explaining it to me, the carrier that had been out before them was delayed and had a mission extended. They had an extended mission, was out for more weeks than they anticipated. And so eventually it was going to happen that the maintenance schedule got backed up. And that's what happened with them. They were in the shipyard. They had to go through some extra maintenance. And then they finally did get out and started conducting strikes on February 13th. When you look at that maintenance issue, it's kind of a good example of what the Navy is trying to fix. President Donald Trump has asked the military for a 30-day review on readiness, and Navy officials tell me that what they are going to say that they need is to fill about $2 billion in fleet operations and ship maintenance, much like that maintenance that delayed the USS Bush's arrival in the Mediterranean Sea. Another big-ticket item that the Navy wants includes a request of about 25 more of the F-18 fighter jets that were shooting off the USS George H.W. Bush while I was there. Those have been very useful in the fight against Islamic State, and they say that they don't have enough funding to include more of them, but they need those.
That is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb joining us from the island of Crete. That was just after being aboard the aircraft carrier of the USS George H.W. Bush. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The furor in Europe over U.S. President Donald Trump's travel ban on citizens from seven majority Muslim states has overshadowed a reservoir of public support for such measures in Europe, according to a poll by the London Policy Institute, Chatham House. And as reporter Henry Ridgewell tells us now from Dresden, Germany, the poll indicated support for ending Muslim immigration averaged 55% across 10 European countries.
Bilal al-Nazir was among the 1.1 million asylum seekers who came to Germany in 2015 after fleeing Damascus when his home was bombed. Shrapnel is still embedded in his head.
I go to doctor hospital. And I need operation in my hand here. And after that, I go into school for learning Deutsch.
While he awaits the operation, Bilal is getting help from a charitable group to find a job.
The federal and state governments have put in place programs to look at how Germany can benefit from the refugees. They are serving the primary needs, language classes, a roof over their heads, and food on the table. Now they need to enable engagement with a local society.
Dresden does not appear to welcome such engagement. It is the birthplace of the Pegida movement, patriotic Europeans against Islamization of the West. Every Monday, supporters march through the city. Guest speaker this week is Renate Sandvoss of Journalist Watch, which claims German media is covering up immigration problems.
Muslim culture, and I say it in quote marks because to me it is not culture, is totally different than the German culture and simply does not fit in here.
When this movement was born more than 2 years ago, the organizers hoped that it would spread across Germany and beyond to the rest of Europe. But so far, that hasn't happened.
There is a good reason why, says Dresden University professor Werner Patzelt.
To put it quite clearly, Pegida is more successful than it has ever been, only under a different label, because AfD is Pegida. AfD is Pegida as a political party.
AfD, the Alternative for Germany party, could become the third largest party in elections scheduled for September. It is one of several far-right parties in Europe feeding off concerns over immigration.
We won't be able to stop immigration. We won't be able to make sure that there is something like a fair distribution of migrants throughout Europe. So this is really a problem at the heart of the European integration process.
However, the latest polls show support for the AfD party is falling. Global uncertainty will likely lead German voters to put economic stability ahead of immigration, analysts say, and Germany's challenge will be to make the migrants part of that economic future. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Dresden, Germany.
The head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that President Trump's administration will begin rolling back Obama-era environmental regulations in an aggressive way. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt says he understands why some Americans want to see his agency eliminated. Pruitt spoke at the Conservative Political Action Conference outside Washington.
The agency that I'm tasked to lead at this point has been used by the previous administration to truly impact our country in ways that we never could have imagined 8 years ago. Jobs have been impacted. The authority that the Washington, D.C. has, the assumption of power and the accumulation of power, they've taken advantage of that. And so I think it's justified. I think people across this country look at the EPA much like they look at the IRS. And I hope to be able to change that.
John Abraham is a professor of thermal sciences. He's at St. Thomas University in the state of Minnesota. He speaks with International Edition's Lori London about the upcoming moves by the new head of the EPA.
Well, what we expect are at least two efforts. One is to roll back protections of waterways in the United States. And that will likely lead to an increased pollution of our waterways. And we've seen over the past few years that water pollution can have serious impacts on people, whether they live in urban or rural environments. And outside the U.S., the rolling back of the Clean Power Plan. Now, the Clean Power Plan is the U.S. commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which would reduce the worldwide impact of climate change. This is really a unmitigated disaster for the environment, because the United States has taken excellent action over the last 8 years to become a leader worldwide on handling pollution. And that's given us a tremendous amount of credibility when we talk to our international partners. And to pull back on these agreements means that we'll go back to the back of the pack. We won't be taken credibly in our international relationships. And furthermore, we're going to become the laggard when it comes to develop the clean technologies for the future, and that means it's going to cost us jobs. So I would disagree with Pruitt's assessment that these regulations cut jobs. These regulations position us to create clean energy economy for the future.
This was a somewhat controversial choice to head the Environmental Protection Agency. How do you see it coming from a climate scientist perspective?
Well, I think it's saying it's controversial is really being light on the pick of Pruitt. I mean, he is heading an agency which he tried to litigate against, or he did litigate against, prior to his appointment. So it's someone who obviously doesn't have faith in the main mission of the EPA, which means he doesn't have the best interests in American citizens at heart, because we need to be protected against pollution caused by a variety of different industrial partners and companies. But what's interesting is just last week, a number of emails were released where approximately 7,500 emails between his office and fossil fuel interests were disclosed. And those emails show that he acted, while he was the Oklahoma Attorney General, he acted in concert with oil and gas companies in a way that challenged environmental regulation. And so it just goes to show that he's had a long and close history with companies who are against EPA regulations in general. And so it's hard to see how he can have an unbiased leadership.
There's been some speculation that Pruitt was brought in to actually sort of dismantle the agency ultimately. Do you see that happening?
That's a tough one. I mean, folks I talked to are concerned that there will be either a complete dismantling of the EPA or rendering it so ineffective that it's essentially dismantled. And what people need to know is having a clean environment is good for the economy. Having a dirty environment, whether it's water pollution or whether it's carbon dioxide pollution or whether it's air pollution from smog or other sources, that costs us all money. And so sometimes these views are put forward as pro-business, but they're not. They're actually anti-economic. And a lot of people are starting to wake up to the fact that you can have a clean environment and a strong economy, but you can't have a dirty environment and a strong economy. So these things, which are supposedly to help the economy, these actions by Pruitt will do the exact opposite.
That is John Abraham, a professor of thermal sciences at St. Thomas University in Minnesota. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. It is time now to find out what's trending on social media. G. Abby Lee here with the latest. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. Not surprisingly, celebrities have been sharing tweets and photos even before the Oscars began Sunday night. The Oscars is the biggest night in Hollywood, and the trending hashtag was, of course, hashtag Oscars. Stars were documenting their glam sessions via Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Some even shared their workout sessions Sunday morning so they can look good in their suits and gowns in the evening.
You know, gee, speaking of the Oscars, the New York Times newspaper ran its first TV ad in 7 years during that event, I believe. What's the social media chatter about all of that?
That's right. The subject on the ad was the truth. The last line in the advertisement reads, "The truth is more important now than ever." President Trump took to Twitter to express his own view about it, writing, "For the first time, the failing NY Times will take an ad, a bad one, to help save its failing reputation. Try reporting accurately and fairly." One of the most notable reactions to that tweet comes from the Daily's national security reporter, Scott Shane. He tweeted, "Generous of POTUS with all he has to do to take a moment to promote our striving news organization and share tips for success."
Hey, that's great information. Thank you. What else is trending?
It looks like the iconic Nokia 3310 is making a comeback. The Finnish communications company is bringing back the 2000-era handheld product with some major upgrades. You can see photos of the new version all over the internet. And that's all for me today. Back to you, Steve.
Many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency says an international group of astronomers has discovered a record-setting pulsar some 50 million light-years from Earth. Using data gathered by the space agency's XMM Newton X-ray Space Observatory and archival data from NASA's New Star X-ray Space Telescope, the scientists say the pulsar is the most distant and the brightest of its kind that has been detected so far. ESA says that every second the pulsar emits the same amount of energy released by our sun over 3.5 years. A pulsar is a type of neutron star, which is the collapsed core of a star that exploded in a massive supernova. What makes it a pulsar is that this particular type of neutron star also pumps out two rotating and pulsing symmetrical beams of electromagnetic radiation that shines so brightly, scientists call them cosmic lighthouses. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. Nominations were recently announced for the 52nd Annual Academy of Country Music Awards, also known in country music as the Party of the Year, honoring the industry superstars and, of course, the hottest emerging talent. Nikki Strong of VOA 1 joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with the details.
So, Nikki, who's leading the pack with the most nominations?
I'm happy to say that our man, Keith Urban, he comes out on top with 7 nominations in 5 categories, including his 7th nod for Entertainer of the Year and his 10th for Male Vocalist of the Year. He was also nominated twice as both artist and producer in the Album of the Year category for Ripcord. And our favorite song off that album, Blue Ain't Your Color.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the running for Single Record of the Year and Song of the Year categories. And then other multiple nominees include Miranda Lambert and Maren Morris. They both have 6. And then Florida Georgia Line and Tim McGraw. They both have 5.
Any surprises or snubs?
Of course, there always is. Carrie Underwood, her album Storyteller didn't get a nomination. Now, that's because works released between November 26th, 2015 and November 23rd, 2016 are eligible. And her album actually dropped in October of 2015. So she just missed it. However, she did get nominated for Entertainer of the Year, which is her first time in 8 years.
Wow.
So a lot of people were happy to see that. Garth Brooks was shut out of the Entertainer category. We were surprised by that. And Blake Shelton didn't get nominated at all. This is the second time in the row that he has been shut out. I don't know why that is, but
yeah.
Hey.
Any predictions?
Well, I think Keith Urban, in general, will do well. I think he will win for Song of the Year for Blue Ain't Your Color. I think his album Ripcord may win for Album of the Year as well. We'll see. It's close, but I think he may inch out and win. Maren Morris, this is interesting. Now, there are two categories. There's the Female Vocalist of the Year category, and there is the New Female Vocalist of the Year category. She is in both. I think she will walk away with at least one of those. But we'll find out April 2nd. That's when the ACMs air live on CBS. Dierks Bentley and Luke Bryan are co-host again. And I will be live tweeting the event and posting updates in Facebook at VOA One The Hits.
Okay, well, you can hear music from all the ACM nominees on VOA One's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Twitter and Facebook at VOA One The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
I know we hurt you, made you scared of love, too scared to love. He didn't deserve you, 'cause your precious heart is a precious heart. He didn't know what he had, I thank God. Oh, and it's gonna take just a little time, but you're gonna see that I.
You know, Keith Urban was on hand at the Academy Awards Sunday night with his actress wife, Nicole Kidman. Big night out there. African-American actor Mahershala Ali won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in the film Moonlight. In fact, thanks to the films like Moonlight, Fences, and Hidden Figures, a record 6 African-Americans are nominated this year. For the first time ever, a person of color is nominated in each acting category. And 4 of the 5 Best Documentary nominees also were directed by filmmakers who are persons of color. Congratulations to all. Lots of names there. Too many to tell you about. Thanks for joining us on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and European Union continue to share similar goals to promote peace and prosperity through freedom, democracy, and the rule of law. And to those objectives, said Vice President Mike Pence on a trip to Brussels, we will remain committed. The United States and EU economies are the world's largest, accounting for half of the world's economic output. Transatlantic commerce and travel for business and tourism support 14 million jobs on both continents and improve the lives and well-being of all of our citizens. We reaffirm our commitment to free, fair, and flourishing economies that undergird our success and to cooperate in achieving that, said Vice President Pence. When it comes to terrorism, said the Vice President, we must be strong and we must be united in our efforts to confront threats to Europe's security and stability. This will require greater coordination and intelligence sharing among EU member states and between the EU and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. In addition to confronting terrorism together, clearly we must stand strong in defense of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of nations in Europe. In the wake of Russian efforts to redraw international borders by force, we will continue to support efforts in Poland and the Baltic states through NATO's Enhanced Forward Presence Initiative, said the Vice President. And with regard to Ukraine, the United States will continue to hold Russia accountable and demand that Russia honor the Minsk agreements, beginning by de-escalating the violence in eastern Ukraine. At the same time, the United States will search for new common ground with Russia, which President Trump believes can be found. The United States' commitment to the EU is steadfast and enduring. We are separated by an ocean, said Vice President Pence, but we are joined by a common commitment to freedom, to democracy, and to the rule of law, and we're confident that that bond will endure and grow.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.